I'm joined here today by Matt Pastrong, President of Post Brothers, Joshua Grossman, Vice President of LEM Capital, and Jeff Adler, Vice President of Yardi Matrix. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me here today. Competition for US multifamily deals is undoubtedly off the charts, which I think actually raises a very fundamental question for investors and managers alike, which is how do you ensure you're only spending time on the most relevant deals that you're likely to win? Now, Matt and Josh, I really want to open this up to you first. Give me a sense as to the competition in the market. Is this actually more competitive today than what you've perhaps seen in the past?
I mean, there's no doubt it's very, very competitive. I think a lot of, you know, the people, the guys we work with and some of the value that we try and provide is, you know, is really trying to outwork our competitors, trying to find creative ways to get a hold of deals, you know, trying to do other things that other than just pay more than the next guy. You know, and sometimes that's okay because you believe you take a view on a deal and you think there's upside that maybe somebody else doesn't see.
Where do you typically source most of your deals from?
You know, we have a network of local operators, you know, guys across the country who, you know their markets inside and out. And these are people we've known and spent time with over the last 36 months, 48 months. I mean, we have partners we've been doing deals with for 12 years. You know, typically spend anywhere from 12 to 18 months getting to know an operating partner before we do a deal. And we want them to know us, get comfortable with us, you know, and the same is true and with us. And, you know, it's important that they understand the way we look at deals. They understand, you know, we understand the way they look at deals. And ultimately, you want to get to somewhere where if something goes wrong, you can sit across a table from somebody, keep the documents in a drawer, and just figure it out.
And Matt, how are you really sourcing those deals? Is it exceptionally more competitive today than what you've perhaps experienced in the past?
We really operate in a much more limited geography than Josh does. So I would say we can invest in 200-mile radius of our office, but really we're focused on Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York to some extent. I will never make an offer on a property if I don't know every asset in the submarket, who owns it, and what their predisposition is to sell to someone else. So I would say that it's not necessarily more competitive for us because we're very focused on what we've always been focused on. We have a building under contract where I've been calling the guy literally every other week for 13 years, and we finally just get it under contract. The price has gone up by 100% in 13 years, but I would say that we're really focused on sourcing opportunities where the capital intensiveness of the property, whether it's marketed or not marketed, it doesn't matter. We've bought, I don't know, 15 properties or so. We've never bought a property once. We bought a property not where there wasn't a broker involved. So the fallacy of off-market deals is it can be a bit of a trap, but at the same time, in some places, some markets, it is very valuable because pricing can get wildly out of control.
Because I think that the holy grail seems to be getting those off-market deals. And I have been told by one GP that there is no such thing in multifamily as an off-market deal. I mean, Jeff, do you disagree, agree?
Or? I disagree. You can, if you want to, convince yourself that there's no such thing as an off-market deal. And then you're really going to be dependent upon what gets brought to you.
That's being a quitter.
And the chief investment officers that I talk to, both at all different organizations, are increasingly saying, I really want to take control of the acquisitions process. I have to improve my response time when there is a broker deal. I have to figure out, and the old ratio used to be, quite frankly, and I ran an acquisition team, you'd have an acquisition team that would look at 100 deals to get one. That's impressively inefficient, impressively expensive. Because you're hiring very expensive talent. But what I increasingly see from chief investment officers is, you know, buying a tool such as ours that allows them to pre-underwrite just about every deal in a city market, to be able to define these are the assets we want. Maybe it's a deep value add, a C asset, an A location, or these are what we're willing to pay based upon this. And I've basically got a book, or spreadsheet more likely, that has every deal in a city market, what they think fair value is given, let's say, the cost of debt, and they're either giving their acquisition teams, here's what I want you to go buy, go get it for me. or to the brokers.
A lot more preliminary underwriting, a lot more digging down and kind of research. Is that what's happening in kind of your firms as well? Are you having to do more preliminary work, more preliminary due diligence, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, we find that sometimes different sponsors will bring us in at different points in the process, and we're more than happy to spec the time up front because, we view it as a partnership. And if we've underwritten the deal, if we've seen it, if we've talked to, had five conversations with the sponsor, by the time the sponsor gets on a best and final call, oftentimes we'll do an initial preliminary investment committee review. And at that point, the sponsor can get on the phone with the broker, say, I've gone through all these different processes. And it just kind of, I think it provides a seller, whether the deal is being marketed or not, with an extra level of confidence that, the equity is, has viewed the deal, they're real, and provides, as close as you can get to certainty of close at that point in the process.
We're also finding that the data that we have is basically being used in the underwriting process for the debt. So they're actually kind of pre-underwriting a lot of the loans now because they're in a very competitive market as well, that they're putting out debt, and it's not just a price issue, it's also a response and certainty of close. So I think these conditions are requiring people, one, to improve their response time, and two, I think to make sure they don't, buy something they didn't really intend to buy at the price they didn't intend to buy it at, which, is always the question of discipline.
What do you want as a seller as well? Are you giving over any time for kind of due diligence? Are you seeing it really kind of squeeze?
If you really want a perfected price on a core asset, I mean, I can talk about this because we're selling a core asset. As a buyer, I operate very differently than the person who buys my property would. So as a buyer, when I sign a contract, I go non-refundable, and that's how I get the deals I get. No one buys core assets that way, really, outside of a few major markets. It's very challenging. When people talk about investment committee, you have to accept that's a fact of life if you want a very aggressive cap rate for your properties. But when we're a buyer, I am the investment committee. So we go, we look, we underwrite, we sign a contract. It's just, it's very different.
And how long is your typical kind of close? Has it been squeezed?
People don't care about how long it takes to close. Often they have 1031 considerations. I mean,
well, if you've gone hard, you put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, I mean, we have 10 to 20 days to go hard, typically, right, from when we learn about a deal, or at least to get a contract.
So, I mean, that's the relevant time frame. Well, when are you going to kind of get serious?
I mean, we go look at a property. We order third parties that day. We have them. We have all of our due diligence. We would really need to close done in 15 or 20 days. We can do it in 10. I think that due diligence periods for properties that need to be substantially repositioned in some way are quickly going away, yeah. I think, or they're going away in certain places. I can only speak to the markets we operate in. I mean, right now, with what we're selling, we have an expectation that the buyer is going to need some due diligence period. But as a buyer, it's just not realistic to expect one.
And Josh, what are your time frames like? Is it becoming much more squeezed when you're actually doing your acquisitions?
We are. I mean, we're finding that some of our sponsors are having to win deals on terms just to give you the right to pay the same price as, as the next guy, or the same price as three other people, more likely. We're finding, due diligence terms, due diligence periods are really kind of 15 days to 30 days, maybe down to 10. If there's a specific kind of a backstory and a context. But, I think like Jeff was saying, the length of due diligence period is really getting squeezed. I think once you have substantial money hard, sellers are comfortable and they're okay with that 30-day close, 45-day close, because people are, realistic. They understand you have to get financing lined up, and the banks just have to work through their process.
But I would say that the main issue is how do you, as a, I think the issue is you want to do as much work as you possibly can, so that you are going after the deals you want to go after, mm-hmm. and you have an idea of what you're willing to pay, which might be refined based upon the last thing you find out, but that you're being proactive, you're driving it, or if you are getting brokered or marketed deals, you can quickly kind of separate the wheat from the chaff and not waste your time on stuff that doesn't fit, and don't spin your wheels, and just focus on the things that work for you, for your investment strategy, and kind of bore in and then be able to bring something significant to the table in terms of a better term, some other play.
Can you actually, be more proactive, for those sellers who are not sellers yet?
That's how you get those owners to sell.
I mean, you said that one deal took 13 years.
Yeah, I mean, a huge amount of real estate is in the hands of entrepreneurial owners that, or they were entrepreneurs and now they're
not
rich entrepreneurs, that are, their kids want to be like something else, you know, write movies or something, and they don't want this $400 million unleveraged real estate portfolio that might be available to them. So it's just when dad says, you know what, capital gains taxes might go up, I'm done, let's sell. You have to stay on top of those people because when they decide, there's a very narrow window. And so the opportunity, the trick is convincing them to sell and then getting it under contract, because then you just lose the window in which you're one of the only person, if the broker tells you, or maybe one of two.
And I think that's the whole point of being able to sort of identify the assets you want,
yeah,
right, and to have a large enough pipeline that, you know, again, you know, Matt's a little different than most organizations where they have an acquisition team that might either be centrally or geographically dispersed. And you have a chief investment officer saying, how am I going to manage my deal pipeline? Where I have a non-traded REIT where they're getting cash in every month, and they have to put that money out. So they have a pipeline they absolutely have to manage and get in front of, and they have to do it wisely. Well, they're using these kind of pre-underwriting tools to basically say, here's the list, go get them. I need a big enough pipeline. Just so you say, it may take 2 years, 5 years, 10 right. years to get a private owner into the market to hit that right time. And in other places, yeah, it really is having enough of a deal pipeline to be able to keep, let's say you have a programmatic, you know, JV, which a lot of organizations do. If you're a sponsor, you got a programmatic JV, and your capital is asking you, what is your deal pipeline? Where is it? They have money that they have to put out to the pension funds, and in order to get a return. So again, you want to make wise deals. You want to make accretive deals that make sense and work. How are you building your pipeline? Are you waiting for it to come to you, or are you going out and finding it?
And when you are obviously dealing with operating partners and JV partners, are you also having to kind of share a little bit more of the upside with them? I mean, just give me, a few kind of the dynamics. Have things changed a little bit? Are you having to share a little bit more in terms of economics?
We have different sponsors that look for different things, right? Some people are focused on current cash flow. Some people are focused on maximizing back end. Some people want to invest 15% of the capital. Some people want to put up 50% of the capital. It all depends. We try and be flexible and find a structure that allows us to achieve, you know, our objectives, both from a cash flow multiple and IRR perspective, and for our sponsors to, you know, to achieve whatever their, you know, specific set of objectives are.
When we talk about off-market deals, are sellers leaving price on the table, or are you not really?
I think it depends on the specific set of circumstances. I mean, I think sometimes there'll be a specific seller who has, you know, an issue, right? Whether it's estate planning or
the property,
or, you know, a tax issue, or the property, or, you know, the loan's maturing. And maybe in that instance, but I think, you know, like we've talked about, the, you know, the off-market deals are very, very rare. They're very rare.
I know ease of execution has been repeatedly cited to me as critical. What exactly do we mean by that?
Having been on both sides of the transactions, I think these other guys have been as well. It's kind of, it's a package, right? So it's a package. So it is, I think most people would say it's more important to make sure a deal is going to get done once you've walked down the path that you're going to do a deal. Because if you don't execute, then you got damaged goods, and the value of the property will go down just because, aha, they couldn't close, okay? So certainty of close is a very big deal. Obviously, you want to go as high as you can on the price side, but if you look to get the very last nickel and the deal, and you picked a buyer that can't close, you just blew yourself up. So I do kind of think it's a package of terms, conditions, how much the money is
we've
hard.
We've done that as a seller, and the buyer didn't perform. It was a big mistake.
It's a big mistake, because then the value of the property is impaired now.
Josh, have you actually won a deal where you weren't the highest bidder?
Absolutely. A lot of these marketed deals, I think exactly what the examples you guys are both giving. I think, you know, the first group steps up with just an outlier bid. Right. You know, a seller tries to hit it, and, you know, that guy can't get his capital lined up. And then we're sitting there at third, you know, with, you know, somebody we've done four deals with, you know, we've got a very conservative underwriting. We've pre-negotiated a term sheet, you know, set of JV docs, or, you know, they're already existing because we've done, you know, several deals together.
Right.
And the broker just doesn't want to take a chance with maybe a questionable second bidder and rather go to a, you know, just a more a solid, you know, third group with a group in third place with a good good reputation, ready capital, and proven that they've already gone down the path of due diligence.